Hello and welcome to The Dominant Paradigm, an American Gods podcast. We're your hosts,
Dwayne D.
Andrew Cersini.
And Tosin Anofawakin.
We just watched the third episode of Starz American Gods' second season, titled Moonin. We assume you have as well, so total spoilers to come. So let's dive into the after talk, but before we do, let's catch you up on how to reach us. These are our online links. You can follow us on Twitter at Gods Podcast or just hashtag The Dominant Paradigm. Our Facebook page is at Podcast American Gods. You can write or send us a voice memo at starsamericangodspod@gmail.com. And you can always check us out on Geeks of Doom. That's where we have the Dominant Paradigm show notes as well as other shows that we host. You can add us on iTunes, and if you do so, please like us and leave us a review. All right, before we break down this episode, Dwayne, why don't you give us a brief recap of what we saw this week?
You got it. So we open up with a train wreck. We realize that the car that Wednesday left on the tracks at the end of episode two didn't get destroyed. It was fine, despite getting hit by a train. The train, on the other hand, it seems to have been destroyed by hitting what's clearly like a magical car. Laura was on the train. She's laying on the ground in pieces. Mad Sweeney finds her and he places the pieces of Laura, who's completely conscious, in the car, Betty's trunk, at Mr. Wednesday's direction. Shadow has been thrown clear and he's like under some sort of sand. Mr. Nancy's nowhere to be seen, even though he was in the car and just recently got out of the car before the train hit it. So we don't know where he went. And of course, Mr. Wednesday's there as well. We see Shadow free of his bonds. He's limping through the woods the next morning, hurt, bleeding, wavering in and out of consciousness. He meets a girl named Sam Black Crow. She drives a Ford Bronco, and he hitches a ride to Cairo. Meanwhile, a crow finds its way to Wednesday, who's at Mr. Ibis's mortuary in Cairo. He's fixing up Laura, Mr. Ibis. Ibis tells Laura that she has a week or so before she falls apart so much that she's unfixable. The crow tells Wednesday that Shadow is alive. Meanwhile, Mad Sweeney's trying to get out of there. He wants to go to Louisiana, and he's going to find somebody there that he needs to help him with luck or something sort of ambiguous like that. He really wants Laura to go with him, but she opts to go with Wednesday instead. On his way, he has a hard time getting transportation. He gets picked up by a tour bus of Christian rockers on their way to New Orleans. Meanwhile, Salim and the Djinn head to what's called the Porn Palace on a classic motorcycle and sidecar. They meet a man named Iktome who will grant their request. If you recall, they were meant to go get Mr. Wednesday's spear. He expects a favor in return. In addition to what they take out with them, they're given a sprouted plant seed. What they're taking out also is a guitar case. So we're not quite sure what's going to be in the guitar case, but we're guessing it's the spear that Wednesday asked for. So, meanwhile, Wednesday convinces Laura to come with him to find Shadow. On the other side of the situation, Mr. World is quarreling with Technical Boy about Argus when the recently missing media reappears as New Media, goddess of global content. She says she needs bandwidth and seeks it from Argus. Argus and New Media merge with the hopes of, quote, synergistic marketing opportunities. Wednesday and Laura go to a data center where Argus takes his residence. They find Argus after looking for him for a while. He's literally tethered to technology, and he's getting bitched out by Technical Boy. Wednesday tells Laura that she should kill Argus, but she disagrees. After Wednesday convinces Laura that he's the one that orchestrated her actual death and that killing Argus can help her live, she consents. So Laura walks in on New Media and Argus merging. She kills Argus, and Technical Boy doesn't at all resist because he's disgusted with the mergingness. Mm-hmm. New Media is upset that she didn't get to, quote, finish the merge, and Technical Boy takes her and escapes. Wednesday states that Argus was a traitor to the old gods, working for the other side, and that though he's dying, he'll come back, and he should remember whose side that he needs to be on. Laura's body regenerates once Argus dies. And then Laura and Mr. Wednesday part ways. When Shadow gets to Cairo, it's late. Mr. Wednesday's back from his little adventure with Argus and Laura. Shadow, having been kidnapped, tortured, and saved by his dead wife, only to be thrown from a crashed train, demands answers of Mr. Wednesday. Mr. Wednesday talks his way out of it, and they go inside Mr. Ibis's house, and that's the end of the episode. So it seems like a plot-building situation here.
Yeah, I mean, if I was being not so kind, I would say that this is a filler episode. But yeah, I think plot building is probably a kinder way to place that.
Well, I figure an 8-episode season, you've got to be introduced to new media. Mm-hmm. This whole situation with Argus and his powers, the fact that he can kind of die and come back, all that stuff is very, very interesting. I feel like that's foundation for possibly something later.
Hopefully. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the salient points about this episode. Let's start with the title, Moonin. So I had to do a little research for this, but I discovered that Moonin is one of Odin's or Wednesday's two ravens. And there's a quote here from a site called NorseMythology.org. Two ravens sit on Odin's shoulders and whisper all the news which they see and hear into his ear. They are called Hugin and Munin. He sends them out in the morning to fly around the whole world, and by breakfast they're back again. Thus he finds out many new things, and this is why he's called the Raven God. So Hugin comes from the word huger, or thought, and Munin comes from the word mooner, which is more difficult to translate, but can encompass the concepts of thought, desire, and emotion. The two ravens' names are often translated as thought and memory in popular works in Norse mythology. And thought is, while Hugin being thought is quite accurate, Munin being memory is kind of arbitrary translation. The two names therefore can't be neatly distinguished from each other, and they overlap to the point of being virtually synonymous. That reflects the fact that in the sources, Hugin and Munin don't have distinct personalities. They're a duplicate form of the same underlying idea. So I think this is a callback to several things, which is, I think thematically we actually see a raven informing Wednesday that of what's going on with Shadow. We meet a person named Sam Blackcrow, so that's sort of an embodiment of another, you know, dark a bird. And then we also get sort of this new media embodiment of someone who is an all-seeing entity in the form of Argus.
Yeah, it's also interesting because obviously throughout the show, first season and this season, we've seen the ravens. I mean, the crows, right? They're both corvids. It's very difficult to tell a crow from a raven, really. Ravens are bigger. But yeah, we've seen the crows all throughout. I mean, we know they had something. They were, you know, we think of them as foreboding, whatever. We know they had something to do. They were kind of always banging about Wednesday. But I think as the show continues, it's the veil of Wednesday as Odin has gone. And so we get exposed to more of Wednesday's existence experience. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we see this stuff. I'm not afraid to say it. Wednesday's crows are poor man's Argus.
Yeah, it's like the low-tech version of the high-tech, which would be Argus, this Argus panopticon, all-seeing, the Argus with the many eyes. And yeah, that's Wednesday's got his own low-tech version, which is the crows.
It's almost like the getting the morning paper is what Wednesday gets.
Yeah.
And then Argus is like your Twitter feed, oh my God, all the time.
Yeah, I mean, although to Wednesday's credit, his crows can interact and can, you know, you saw them sort of attacking a drone and getting in the way. So they do have a little bit more capabilities.
And they're not
editorial review.
They're not one-sided either. You know, we heard Wednesday's crow basically tell Shadow in his sort of dreamlike state to go to Cairo and seek out the Egyptians. So they're messengers as well. Two-way messengers as well.
That's true.
I wanted to mention that stacking on to what I had mentioned last week, where it seemed like Wednesday wasn't that concerned about what was going on with Shadow. If you remember last week, I mentioned that he in referring to Laura Moon wanting to follow Shadow, he said, you know, she seems to think he needs help. And it seemed like Wednesday had a lot more faith in Shadow than anybody else had or anyone else was letting on. In this episode, we see a little bit more of a reinforcement of that. I think he still has faith in Shadow making his journey without any external help. He even says to Mad Sweeney, the quickest way for Shadow to get where he's going is sometimes the longest. So I think that Wednesday
knows...
Happens
to me on Waze all the time, by the way. Happens to me on Waze. He makes me go extra miles, even though, because there's no traffic on those
right,
miles.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I think Wednesday really knows something about Shadow's journey that neither Shadow nor anyone else does. He's got the inside track.
Piggybacking on that, it's interesting because on one level that could lead to like random side quests, but it doesn't really. We know that he's going somewhere Wednesday wants him to. On the other hand, I think thematically the audience is kind of like, so what's the deal with Shadow? He's the cipher. We're always learning through him. And so Wednesday having confidence in Shadow in turn gives us confidence in Shadow.
Right.
It's like when you're reading a book and they keep on telling you that some character is beautiful, like, okay, she's beautiful. Like, he's reinforcing that for us, this character trait. And I think also one of the things that we need to think about is Wednesday might have an ulterior motive. He seems to have one for everybody. So it may be that he's either conditioning people to let Shadow do what he needs to do on his own, mm-hmm. or for whatever reason, he needs Shadow to do things on his own. Because I just, you know, it's hard to trust Wednesday is the thing. He seems to always have an understanding of what's going on. All right, one thing I wanted to get into was Ibis and this cat, right? So the whole Argus thing was really theoretical until this episode, right? And we see Ibis talking to his cat about Zeus and Hera, the Greek gods.
Right.
He says, basically, no matter their story, they all fall victim to their lust for worship. He talks of how Zeus seduced Io and how his sister wife Hera was angry at that. And seduced back in the day just meant he like figured out a way to sleep with her. So Hera was angry with Io for having sex with Zeus. She turns Io into a cow. And then she had Argus watch the cow, put her in a special place, you know, so Zeus can even find the cow. So basically she hid Io from Zeus. Zeus kills Argus, and Hera has Argus reborn in the U.S. as the god of surveillance. I like this story because it took the Greek god situation. You know, we're constantly meeting new gods, and we're thinking of them. And our headcanon kind of has to translate that god from his or her space in the old pantheon that they're attached to into the U.S., into the modern world, into... you know, this new paradigm, right? The paradigm of the United States. And so here, Ibis is telling us, not that Hera had the giant reborn with all these eyes. Instead, he's like, oh, she had him reborn into the United States. which means the Hera he's talking about is an American god Hera on some level, because she had to know about the United States and all that stuff. In any event, Argus's followers waned. His sight became less and less so that an alliance with the new gods can keep him thriving. That was a good foundation for what we then found later. Argus literally plugged in to Technical Boy's wares in order to use his gift. Because if you think about it, Argus isn't a question of just seeing everything. He's kind of processing everything, right?
Yeah.
So when Mr. World, was it, wants to know what's going on with the old gods, wants to see the old gods, he can just say, Argus, show me the old gods. And Argus, who's looking at everything, kind of like Heimdall in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, so you can ask him what's going on somewhere, and he's like, oh, I can see him. He's like, okay, let me just show it to you. So that was pretty pretty clever.
I have to say, though, that the way that the scene was delivered with Ibis talking to his cat, it was really sort of a clunky exposition moment. I mean, he's literally using talking to his cat as a way of them telling this story, this backstory, exposition backstory to the audience. And I felt like there's...
I don't know that we're going to see Hera and Zeus and Io and the seduction in a flashback. And I know, but feel like not like a side quest.
I also didn't feel like we necessarily needed all of that backstory exposition, and it just felt like there could have been a more organic way to do that than him talking to his cat and telling him a story. But whatever.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I see that's a good criticism. I look at that and I think to myself, I relish that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Allusions to the old stuff. I want to hear it. I find myself talking to my kid who doesn't understand what I'm saying about how things have come to be, right?
Sure.
The reason why I'm cooking. So I kind of felt like and that's always when I'm doing something. So when I'm folding clothes or when I'm, when I'm working on something. So I find that when I saw him working on Laura's body.
Sure.
And talking to the cat, that's to me an organic, so to speak, a spontaneous way, a way that I would pass the time.
Sure.
And I do talk to my cats in that way. I get it as a piece of television.
Right.
It may not have been the most compelling way.
That's all I'm saying.
But I do think that it was more effective.
Yeah.
Right. I do think it was more effective than having some weird flashback with a filter on it, seeing Zeus and Hera and a cow and all that stuff. But I also feel like Neil Gaiman loves that stuff too. He loves these old stories.
Oh, he does so much.
Yeah. Right. And that's why I'm excited for what we're gonna see when Matt Sweeney gets down to New Orleans, right? But that's where we are. That's how Argus shows up.
Yeah, so for me, one of the things that I found interesting was that concept of Argus throwing off his old body and kind of just leaving it lying in a field. And then later on, after Laura kills Argus, how Wednesday mentions to him, you know, I'll see you in a later form. And that really does give this credit to the idea of being able to return to a new form, that Argus may continue to, you know, come back and live on. Also makes you, because, you know, maybe he is, since he's playing both sides, maybe him still being connected to the new, to Mr. World and the new gods gives him more power to return, unlike what we saw with the old gods who may or may not return.
Yeah, I think you're right, because Mr. Wednesday called Argus the deep state and all these things, which we'll get into a little later, but people believe in the deep state. People believe in Big Brother. And so that sort of like converted belief keeps Argus going, whereas Zariah is just too abstract a concept for people to really get behind today. So while Zariah might be gone forever, people's belief in the deep state will have Argus come back. Now, it'll be a different avatar of Argus, but it'll be related. The weird thing to me, though, was how does he just die? Like in the field, he's like, okay, I did what I had to do here, so it's time for me to leave. So he just like plops down dead, or like in the Library of Alexandria replicant. Like he just kind of, I don't know. It's a kind of altered carbon kind of thing, maybe, but maybe it's not. The mechanism of that death was very strange to me.
Yeah, I can't say that I understood it entirely. That whole sequence, you know, in Alexandria and in the field with the cow that became a woman, it was a little, all of that was really ambiguous to me.
That made sense to me because that's Io, right?
Sure.
So the idea is that Io is a woman turned to a cow.
Uh-huh.
When you kill the cow, you get the woman back. It's just that she's dead.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is why Ibis' story was relevant just a few minutes later.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, whether we needed to see the field in Alexandria is a question for debate. Speaking of being dead, Mr. Wednesday describes Laura as a revenant, right? I thought that was pretty interesting. So a revenant is effectively a person who's returned from the dead. to try and win an Oscar, right? Leonardo DiCaprio. So if you've seen the Revenant film, 2015, Leonardo DiCaprio, that character's son gets killed by the character played by Tom Hardy. And people think he's dead because he was mauled by a gigantic bear. And he seems to come back from the dead for the express purpose of effectively taking revenge, right? And so that idea that Laura Moon is indeed a revenant, that she's there for the purposes of something, and the fact that Wednesday says it's single use. Now, should we trust Wednesday? Never. But this idea that she's she's back to do one particular thing is burned into her head. And now it leaves us, the audience, wondering, what is she back to do? Is she back to help Shadow? She's helped Shadow a couple times. She's still here. And if she does the thing, is she just going to drop dead? Something that was interesting. We now have this kind of space where we're like, what's Laura's purpose reborn? But we have a name for what she is. Whereas if you read the book, there's no name for, there's no, she's not named. She, I mean, I guess you could have put that together yourself, but back in 2001, I was too stupid to do that. I don't know about you guys. But yeah, that's one interesting thing we learned about Laura, but there's other stuff, huh, Andy?
Yeah. So, Laura is not the girl that Shadow fell in love with anymore. At least that's Wednesday's claim, from what I recall from the story. And I think we are going to get into that a little bit more, a little bit later in the in our big picture section. But in the meantime, Tosin, why don't you tell us a little bit about Sam Black Crow?
Yeah, so that girl, Shadows, is with, kind of sees herself as both male and female, right? So she sees herself as not having a particular gender and a tomboy of sorts. I'm not necessarily sure that if the performance we see is what you consider non-binary, but that's kind of the angle that she's going at. And I think it's kind of interesting to see this part of the story that we've all been kind of desiring to hear play out kind of start to build into fruition.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting too. So Sam Black Crow, I mean, first of all, her name is Sam, right? So it's Samantha, like, you know, you'd assume. But the nickname Sam is a non-binary nickname, works for boys and girls. The show has had a lot of diversity on it so far. You have people from all over the world, right? But at the same time, we haven't seen this kind of diversity. I've actually never seen a non-binary character in a TV show before. And as I think our society has...
The Sabrina Netflix show has a non-binary character. And I think there was another one in... it's not the first, certainly.
So it's the first one I've seen. I haven't seen that Sabrina show. But I will say that it's a step toward taking that 2001 book and making it relevant for today.
Sure.
Because that 2001 book was trying to be super relevant back then when it came to people who, shall we say, are underrepresented or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm interested in seeing how the character plays out. I remember the character from the books. And I thought that it was pretty interesting how the take on her. She doesn't look like how I imagined her. But at the same time, her kind of ambivalence toward everything, yet interest in everything, was something that I palpably remember from the book. So
she mentioned in this episode that she feels like she is of two spirits, and there's actually a term in amongst Indigenous North Americans called Two Spirit, which is used to describe certain people in the community who fulfill a traditional third gender ceremonial role in their cultures. So just beyond the sort of binary roles that are conventional.
So like not even non-binary, it's trinary.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So it's an interesting, right. And it makes perfect sense being that this character is indigenous American.
Right. Right.
Oh, yeah. I didn't catch that. Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think we'll see how this character ends up developing throughout sort of the next upcoming episodes and sort of what role that she plays in the story. Like if it continues to align with what we've seen in the novel or if it becomes utterly separate. And
one thing I did like was when Shadow's like, you're human, right?
Right.
She's like, huh? Yeah, duh. Right. So that was interesting. So, another interesting thing here was when we meet that guy who gives Shadow when he gives the Jin and Salim the guitar case, right?
Right.
he also is doing something in his kind of his weird his sort grow of marijuana. His grow house. He takes a single seed, puts it in water, and it instantly sprouts, right? And so,
well, what's that about? Did you have any theory about that?
I mean, having read the book, I don't want to spoil what it, sure. what it might mean to anyone who hasn't read the book, but who's like avidly following the TV show. But it threw me kind of as an interesting way in this age where marijuana is in these like weird iffy places, right? So it's a grow house. It seems like it'd be illegal, but at the same time, you know, I'm here in Boulder and you can see grow houses because recreational marijuana is legal and people will get to grow it, right? Meanwhile, across the country, you've got hemp that's now legal. And you've got medical marijuana facilities. So marijuana is in this space that it wasn't in back when the book was written, 2001. And this idea that these porn guys are also like selling drugs, it kind of goes with that flow as well. So it was interesting. But the visual was great. I knew exactly what was happening, mm-hmm. you know, seed sprouting, whatever. But it made sense that it was in a grow house for that to happen. Because if he was just sitting in some office and he did it, he'd be kind of like, okay, that was weird. But the fact that he is a sort of green thumb to begin with, that he's into this stuff, that was that was interesting.
Yeah, indeed. All right, let's talk about the moment later on in the episode where New Media and Argus merge together. What a weird sort of merging that was. It was like,
do you want to get rid of the euphemism of merge?
Well, I mean, essentially they were having sex, right? Like there was a consummation, I will say. There was a symbiotic relationship that they were trying to fulfill, right? So New Media wanted the bandwidth that Argus had in order to basically spread her message to the widest followers. Like she's totally represents this.
She's
sort of
UGC, right? Like user generated content is kind of what she represents.
Right, right. Well, she represents like the typical social media maven who is right. trying to get the most followers and the most likes. And I'm not sure. I don't recall what purpose, what part of that. That symbiotic relationship. What does Argus get out of it?
I think he wants to be. So he wants to be worshipped, right? That's what Mr. Ibis was saying. Everyone falls like for the lust of worship. So the idea that if they merge her content on his bandwidth, then people are using his bandwidth. They're asking for his favor effectively. Let me bask in your bandwidth, right? Let me gain access to you, which is a thing that God's like. And then there's this idea that, you know, like you said, social media maven. She's Snapchatting, she's Insta, she's Facebook, she's all these things, she's tweeting. And you actually see like the emojis rise out of her during the whole exchange of information, let's say. But I also think it kind of gives, on a wider level, it gives Argus purpose. Because he's sitting there, he's looking around, he's feeding Mr. World the information he wants. But I feel like he gets more purpose when this content is going across his bandwidth, right?
Mm.
Right. So, I don't know. I mean, obviously, there's other stuff I can get into later, but I guess first we should mention sort of what we saw visually. Tosin?
Yeah, so, I mean, very sort of anime-esque, where you could make comparisons to tentacle porn or other things of that nature. Maybe a sort of a bit of Matrix-esque, where
dare we say hentai?
Yes. And then in the Matrix, you see, people sort of jacked into the system, mm-hmm. or any sort of like sci-fi fiction where you have to plug in.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously really phallic. The first thing was sort of like he's got all these cords going into him, and then like these wires kind of wrap around her legs. But at the end of like whatever sort of like corded thing that he was using to touch her, there was definitely a phallus put in there, right? Mm-hmm. And it was weird because they didn't really. It seemed like a practical effect. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah.
Rather than like CGI or whatever, it seemed almost like someone was manipulating it, but. It was one thing when it goes around her leg, okay, merging. But then one of these tentacles goes, you know, she's standing with her leg shoulder width apart and she's wearing a skirt, and it just goes kind of right in there. And her reaction to it was very obviously a reaction of, let's call it, penetration.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
So yeah, at first I was like, are they going to do that? And I was like, oh, they're going to do that. And yeah.
I don't think there was any question as to what that was. there was no subtlety in that at all.
I would agree with Tosin that, like, I don't know if they had to take it there, but I suppose if you're running that show, you're like, oh, we're taking it there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it didn't get, like, completely, like, super whatever. It wasn't like a Bilquis moment, but it was almost more shocking, right?
They're like, are we on cable or are we on special fry? Oh, we're not? Okay, let's go for it.
Right. And so it kind of felt to me as if even though it wasn't like super nude or whatever, it felt explicit. It felt violative. It felt like the kind of thing, you know, if my mom were in the room next to me, I'd blush, right? Which is hard because I have very dark cheeks. It felt like the kind of thing that, like, I would not want to, like, watch when I was sitting next to my wife. It just felt, for lack of a better term, wrong. But, you know, I guess she'd say if loving bandwidth is wrong, she doesn't want to be right. I don't know.
Yeah.
Net neutrality. I mean, it was extremely explicit. It was also very intimate, which is probably why Technical Boy was so upset about it, right? He's like, I can't believe you're doing this in front of me, right?
Well, I don't. What I read from that was that he was upset that he was. They were doing that in front of him. It's just that, you know, they went in there with this plan, and then she sort of there's a power play, definitely a power play going on between New Media and Technical Boy. You saw that in the scenes leading up to meeting Argus. So when New Media jumps in and says, you know, let me take care of this, and she starts seducing Argus, I feel like Technical Boy was feeling usurped, and I think that's
he's like, yeah, I'm supposed to handle Argus, not you.
Yeah, so I think that's part of the reason why he allowed Laura Moon to go in there and stab Argus, because it's like it'd be like taking care of killing two birds with one stone, getting two of his opponents out of the way.
Right, because Argus wasn't playing ball in the way he wanted him to, but it was strange. Now. What was your guys's? I mean, I mentioned my general reaction.
Yeah.
Tosin mentioned his. What was your general reaction to the whole visualization of weird kinky tentacle robot sex?
It's sort of basic, not basic cable, but standard pay cable sensationalism. I didn't feel like, you know, it wasn't necessarily necessary, but I wasn't offended by it. It's just like, you know, this is what they're doing to get ratings. They want to sort of jazz up the show. That's fine.
I got you. I mean, did you feel like the level of, oh my God, I guess I felt, or no, you were like, whatever.
I was like, whatever. I've seen, you know, having seen many seasons of Game of Thrones, like none of that phases me. Trust me.
Gotcha. So the thing about it is that, like, a naked person on screen, like, I'm kind of like, whatever. Yeah. I was definitely thrown off by the whole, I'm going to put a tentacle up your body. So why do they want to get together? So New Media mentions why, you know, we can get together and look for synergistic marketing opportunities, right? Now, why would that matter to New Media? What is a synergistic marketing opportunity? Well, if you at all listen to our other podcast, the technology podcast, The Drill Down, we talk about how Facebook and other social media companies use content, user-generated content, and data to advertise, right? And here's the deal. If you work on the advertising side, on some level, advertisers, they worship the content. And that's like a good metaphor, right? So an advertiser cares about content. You've heard the term content is king, right? So when Google ranks pages, it ranks them based on the quality of the content. Facebook is a big deal because Facebook generates a lot of content. And that's why advertisers want to be there. And when they want to get there, that's one of the reasons why Google and Facebook are the two of the largest advertising companies in the world. So what do you do when you worship something? You you spend a lot of time and energy on it, or you donate to it. You give it a lot of money. So these advertisers are pushing money toward these platforms. And the fact that she is the content, pardon me, is the content on these platforms, and she's getting those eyeballs, all those people like, I want to be like Khloe Kardashian. I want to be like whatever new media is going to be in terms of her avatar online. That's the thing where she gets the juice. She gets advertiser juice. She gets user juice. And Argus gets some juice too, because he's the one that they have to use in order to get that message out there. So it's a really, in an interesting cynical way, it's a interesting metaphor for how the new gods actually maintain their power, right? They maintain their power because there's a type of worship that happens. I mean, how many hours are people spending on Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp a day, right? Snapchat a day. Nowadays, your iOS device will tell you. And so that's kind of where this whole idea of like new synergistic marketing opportunities meant. And I think it was so strange and weird and callous, but at the same time, it made so much sense. But I really think, again, I guess the theme of the show, that they're really trying to bring it up from 2001 to now.
So let's close out our salient points here. Dwayne, you wanted to mention, talk about Wednesday sacrificing that cow, Io.
Right. So when Wednesday asks Laura her mission and sacrifices the cow, Io, that's under Argus's traditional protection. As he does kill it, it turns into a woman. Then they find a new dead version of Argus in the library, which is supposed to represent Alexandria, and they burn the entire library as a sacrifice.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting way to spend time in an episode. I don't know that it was needed. I mean, I guess we mentioned that a little earlier. But I do think that they're really trying to give foundation to this idea of Argus, which leads me to believe that he's going to become more important later.
Yes. So we're gonna have to look out for that. See how that rolls up. Any questions from this episode that you were left with that you want to know going into the next episodes?
Well, I mean, there were a few questions we had. We had one question from last week that we got answered, right? Whether or not it was the same train, and yes, confirmed pretty much in the very beginning of the episode, mm-hmm. was the same train that Wednesday put Betty in front of. But that leads to another kind of question. Is it seemed at the end of last week's episode that Wednesday was sacrificing Betty, but Betty's still around and kicking. So what kind of car is Betty, and can I get one of those? And
yeah, that was weird. That was weird, because you know, it's a car like any other, and then suddenly you realize that it's invincible or indestructible, which is interesting, because I'm trying to think of an indestructible thing in Norse mythology that could stand in for Betty, and I can't do it. So I don't know, maybe we'll find out later. But yeah, what kind of car is Betty? I was going to ask what the germinating seed was, but we kind of went over that in the,
right.
in the salient points.
Yeah. We don't know, or I don't remember, honestly, from the book. So let's just hold off on expanding on that. But we're going to have, we do have some more questions, but we're going to save them for the big picture section, which is, right now. This is how that's the salient visual points of the episode and our questions. Let's move on to the big picture, where we discuss how the episode, the events in this particular episode impact what we know about the overarching story arc. So, we talked about Argus last week. What have we learned about him this week that helps us understand his role better?
Well, one of the things that we learned here is the deep state, as we kind of covered above. You notice that when Wednesday is looking at that tabloid, it shows a deep state and sort of this shadow figure that people are talking about or believing in. And as Dwayne put earlier, we hear a lot of Wednesday actually calls out Argus as the deep state later on. So,
yeah, it was also interesting to me because I never really heard of the deep state. pardon me, until I don't know, 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was not a term that I even knew existed until I kind of heard some politicians talking about the deep state. So kudos to them for, again, keeping the show relatively relevant. Mm-hmm. I also think it was interesting how it was in a tabloid, because, you know, we just mentioned that Wednesday kind of gets his Ravens to give him the information in the morning. So he's like also grabbing a paper in the morning. And if you guys remember Men in Black, the movies, the character played by Tommy Lee Jones, he'd go to the newsstand and he'd buy a whole bunch of tabloids, like, you know, Bat Boy, this, that, the other thing. And that's where he got his news, because all those freaky happenings were actually, you know, the extraterrestrials behaving and people not making sense of it, so it ended up in the tabloids. That paradigm, for me, works when it comes to American Gods. The paranormal activity, all that stuff, ends up in the tabloids because news is constantly looking for verifiable sources, and these things can't be explained through those means. So that was pretty interesting to me.
Dwayne, what else we got here?
All right, so Laura's regeneration shows that she's not just alive for Shadow. So what's she alive for? Like, why is she here? We know that she cheated on Shadow.
Yeah.
She died with her best friend's, like, husband's penis in her mouth. She tried to kill herself before.
Yeah.
Which leads me to believe that on some level it's like she wanted to get out of here, but she's still here. But for whatever reason, she completely believes in Shadow, or at least she did at the beginning of the episode. She kind of said, I don't know what you guys are. I'm a complete and utter atheist. I'm not interested in any of you. I believe in Shadow. I see him as a big, bright light, which has to mean something. But the fact that she was regenerated by Argus, does that mean something else? I don't know. What do you guys think?
I mean, I still maintain that she sees Shadow as basically the one true love and the thing that she wants to come back alive and live for. I don't know. Maybe it's just the romantic in me, and maybe I'm forgetting details from the book if it's beyond that. But, you know, I think this episode feels like it's with her choosing to leave with Wednesday instead of being revived by Argus's regeneration of her coin, and then going off on her merry way. It seems to prove that her North Star is true, and it's still with Shadow.
Right. She does get left, right? So she's sitting on the floor. She's distraught because maybe Wednesday's right. Maybe she's not there for Shadow. Maybe she betrayed him. Maybe, right? She's got a whole bunch of doubt. But at the same time, it's sort of like, what if Wednesday's just lying? What if, killing a god's going to up the juice inside the coin that keeps her animated and alive? Yeah. And what if that's just how some of these things work, but Shadow is still her reason? That's kind of where I was.
Yeah.
Can't trust Wednesday.
One of the things that I was, I was quite surprised that she decided to trust Wednesday instead of, going with Sweeney, right? But one of the things I kind of believe that she'll probably go on her own vision quest. This will allow Shadow to continue his
side quest,
until she comes to this point of realization that, yes, in fact, like, protecting, saving Shadow is her one true desire, and she'll come back in moment of need.
Oh, so sort of like a Deus Ex Machina kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like the whole thing with, like, Shadow as a being pulsing light means that he still has to mean something to her. But I was kind of surprised she didn't go with Mad Sweeney. She doesn't seem to trust Wednesday. But at least Mad Sweeney, she can handle. Even when she's in pieces, she hits Mad Sweeney. He flies across the room. He's like, ow. But the fact that, I guess on some level, going to Louisiana would mean leaving Shadow a very long distance, right? And she doesn't want to do that. So that's why she didn't go with Mad Sweeney. Or Wednesday seems in charge. Mad Sweeney does not seem in charge. He seems like he's just along for the ride. So going with him isn't helpful either. He doesn't know what he's doing, right? Also, they had gone to Easter, and Easter was like, I can't help you. And that was Mad Sweeney being like, hey, she can help you. So maybe Wednesday, you know, she doesn't trust the devil she knows, Mad Sweeney, and she's like, maybe Wednesday has something going on here. Either way, she looks a whole bunch healthier, and you know, she's literally got a new lease on whatever type of life she's living.
Yeah. Wednesday says that it tells her that Shadow loved the girl who tried to kill herself with bug spray, not the one who will kill a god to keep her heart ticking. And the question is Laura, in fact, the woman that Shadow fell in love with? Has she in compromising her morals, has she no longer become the type of person that Shadow would be in love with?
Right. I mean, does she even have morals? I mean, she has some kind of morals. Her morals are like aligned, are about like protecting Shadow, I guess.
Yeah.
But it all seems like it's overcompensation for having disappointed Shadow. Who knows what happened? You know, we know that she had an affair, but who knows what really happened to Laura, who tried to kill herself when Shadow was in jail. But we do know that she was going to kill herself, and because of Shadow, she didn't. And while Shadow was in prison, she would still talk to him all the time, you know, phone calls, whatever. So she, like, Shadow was like an anchor, even when he was away. Sure, she did the infidelity thing, and that's obviously a very serious thing and a huge plot point here, and she's got a lot of shame around that. But at the same time, the infidelity may have just been sort of a kind of thing where it's like, I needed to get it from somewhere, and this guy was right here. But at the end of the day, even when you see kind of like the flashback about how she died, she's like, well, Shadow's coming home. I can't hook up with him anymore. Right?
Yeah.
And so she kind of gave him a pity oral sex situation before they died, before they both died. So even when she was alive, Shadow was a reason to live. So I think that's important to mention.
Indeed.
But so, well, here's my question.
Yeah.
Who is Wednesday sacrificing to, right? So he's got the car, he puts it on the road. We thought it was a sacrifice. It's clearly not a sacrifice, because the car's intact. He sacrificed Io. You know, Hera, the, you know, sister wife to Zeus and queen of gods, she was like, she said, hey, I don't want this cow dead, and he killed the cow, right? So what higher power is he sacrificing to? He sacrificed the cow in order to find his way over to the Library of Alexandria. He sacrificed the Library of Alexandria. And these things he doesn't seem to care about. So he doesn't care about Io, and he doesn't care about the Library of Alexandria. He just wants what he wants. When I think about sacrifice, I think about, this is something I really care about, and I'm going to give it up for the purpose of, for a greater purpose. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I kind of wonder what the sacrifice is, and are there going to be repercussions for all these killings that he's perpetrating?
Repercussions for Wednesday? I don't think so.
Right. I mean, like, who's the higher power that he would sacrifice to begin with, right?
Titans?
In fact, yeah, I guess. I mean, he's different pantheon, but yeah, that's the only thing that's above the gods. And on some level, I mean, we know that Odin sacrifices himself to himself. It's a narcissistic sacrifice.
Yeah.
I just don't get, I don't get it.
I mean, also, in this instance, Laura did ultimately do the killing, at least when they killed. Now, I don't know that it's considered a sacrifice, but killing Argus could be.
Yeah, he has like a sacrificial knife, and they do it inside of some special part of his body, right? Some weak spot, some sort of like a, you know, like Attack on Titan by his neck kind of thing. Yeah, it was very strange. And because of the way she killed him, she got the juice, right? She got like the Highlander quickening action coming out of her. But yeah, I just don't understand who he's sacrificing. What's going on there? Anyway, Tosin, you want to talk about the bad guys?
Yeah. So, you know, I think we have this like Boris and Natasha syndrome going on, where the bad guys are bickering and fighting, and a lot of infighting. You have quirky conversations within the good guys, but they're far more together, right? They're far more aligned. The old gods are far less distracted than the new gods, which maybe says something about this day and age. Usually this type of trope spells doom for the bad guys, right? The squirrel and moose get their way.
Right, like Skeletor is always trying to attack the people who work under him. Cobra Commander is like killing people who work under him. It's always like the bad guys are fighting the bad guys. That's interesting. What's also interesting is that how few bad guys there are, right? I don't know what happened to Mr. Town. He's probably dead. But Mr. World, Mr. Town, New Media, and Technical Boy, that's kind of all we got. That's the whole team. Versus everybody who was in backstage and basically looked like a whole bunch of people, 12, 13 people were hanging out in that that diner before Zariah got shot. So, you know, once again, I mean, bad guys, they've always got more resources, more power, that kind of thing. And, I mean, are they really the bad guys? Who knows? Is it better to drop the old gods and move forward? That's a weird thing, you know? Meanwhile, I like the fact that Sam Black Crowe lived between two worlds. She's got her mother's devout Christianity and her father's native heritage, right? And I don't know about you guys, but I like that because it reminded me that America's a melting pot, which is kind of the point of the book. Gaiman's like he's driving across America and he's realizing how many cultures have to come together. It's not just a question of like a Kamala Harris where like an Indian woman and a Jamaican guy got together. It's the blending of culture, like, you know, German culture and Russian culture and British culture, and, you know, obviously you've got natives and obviously you've got you know, people of African descent, whatever. But these cultures, it's more subtle than sort of like the color of someone's skin. There's all these cultures melding together. And when you look at Sam Black Crowe, she's, you know, to look at her, I think on the eye, she tells you she's, you know, Native American, you believe her. But if she didn't tell you that, you might think that she's not, you know what I mean? Mm. Like, the lens is based on the information you have, not because she's walking around in like native garb or anything like that, or she has a particular look to her. If she told you she was from India, you might believe that too. The actress who's playing her definitely has a kind of a universal look, let's just say. So for me, I'm the kid of an immigrant. I felt like I had that dual world thing too. You know, the home life versus outside life. Mom, that's not American. Mom being like, who cares? that sort of thing. Have any of you guys kind of experienced that kind of dual life here in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I think both you and I are children of immigrants and, you know, born in Nigeria and have a Nigerian passport. And so really that sort of melting pot of cultures, right? Not just, you know, lived most of my life here in America. And so there's that element in me, but there's also the element from, you know, Africa and Nigeria and sort of the bonds and ties that are there.
Right, right. What about you, Andy?
You know, I'd love to say that I do, but I feel like for the most part, we're pretty homogenous on our end of things. So
that's interesting coming from a guy named Andy Socini, whose heritage comes through Mexico. Yeah. I definitely feel like there's multiple worlds going on.
Sure,
with
but in recent history, we're fairly homogenous. I think you'd have to go back further generations than we keep track of on our end too. To dig into that.
Gotcha. What did you want to say about Mr. World and Technical Boy?
Oh, yeah. You know, what's interesting here is that when Mr. World directs Technical Boy to physically go to Argus, and Technical Boy pushes against that a little bit and like, you know, why can't we just do this digitally?
And text him, right?
Text him. And Mr. World insists, he says, tradition, we build the new world on top of the ruins of the old, which is an interesting point in that these new gods, they can't live without the, they basically need, in order for the new gods to conquer, they have to do so upon the foundation of the old gods.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty cool. I mean, if you think about the fact that, you know, we're constantly standing on the shoulders of those who came before us.
Yeah.
And while the new gods in season one, they seemed almost completely and utterly irreverent of the old gods. Like, Odin, who are you? Like, get out of here. You don't belong here anymore. Right? Look, go to Korea. Go to North Korea where we'll carve out a place for you or something. But we want winner take all the favor of all the people. And the new gods are interesting because back in the old days, back in the ancient Greek times, you know, if you were in Athens, they worshipped Athena. But if they were somewhere else, they worshipped, you know, another god, right? They might worship Apollo. Not everybody worshipped the same gods, even though they were part of the same sort of loose religion, the same pantheon, the Greek pantheon. When you get to Rome, people were devotees of one god or the other. It was kind of more, it was more integrated, these different gods. But when you look at the new gods, though, you know, Americans, you know, theoretically worship media, worship technology, worship like they're kind of like, you know, are kind of like global standing in the world, Mr. World, all these things, right? So everybody, well, most everybody is giving their favor and time to all of these gods, these new gods. So even though there are fewer of them, they're not just getting a piece of the population. They're getting the entire population, or most of it, right? Their share of time, of all that stuff, that they're getting more juice out of everybody. So it's interesting that they're kind of like, you guys need to get out of here so we can get even more time from these people. What's also interesting about this whole idea of being building the old world and the ruins of the new is that there are plenty of words today that we still use that are not just words that come from older languages, but they actually come from things like gods, right? So the Roman goddess of agriculture, Ceres.
Sure.
Right? That's where we get cereal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When you think about just like the Frigg, right? That's the Norse god of fertility. And that's where we get Friday from, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got, there was a vengeance deity in Greek mythology. Her name is literally Fury, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we've got all these different words that we're still using, and they're literally built on the ruins of an ancient world, right? That pantheon, like, no one is really, like, maybe there's a few devotees of the ancient Greek pantheon, but no one's really following that. It's not a major thing. Even when you go to ancient Greece, all they have left is ruins. And yet, right, these words are important to our ability to not just communicate, but to think, right? Fury, that's an emotion we put a name on, and that name is actually a god. So I think that was a pretty tight piece of writing by the writers there. All right, last thing from these big picture things.
Mm-hmm.
Wednesday seems to have organized Laura's death. Yeah, at least he claims so. He said people shouldn't worry about Shadow, which is another thing. So he's kind of organizing around Shadow. Like, if he can orchestrate her death, which seemed completely like an accident, then he's got a watchful eye on Shadow, and he's kind of making sure that Shadow's not going to get harmed. But I think they really stirred Laura up. You know, she's a puppet. He's pulling the strings. And I think that we should take that as kind of the big picture for the whole thing. Once again, I think Wednesday is, he's up to something. And if you've read the book, you understand that he is up to something. But the way they're showing it in the show, you know, they could keep us a twist, whatever. But it makes me feel as if, at first I thought he was kind of like going along to get along. But now I really feel like he's pulling some strings. Oh, Shadow, don't worry about me telling you the answers. Have a drink. If you don't feel great in the morning, you can take Betty and go. All that stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah. One last thing I wanted to mention before we move on here is that in last week's episode, we saw that that Wednesday sends Salim and the Djinn to Mitchell to go to the Corn Palace, which is an actual roadside attraction in Mitchell. It's this basically this multi-purpose facility that is made out of corn and decorated with corn.
Right, and Salim is like, I thought this would look more like corn.
Right. So when they
when we get there,
we realize that it's the Porn Palace, and you could see that part of the sign that said porn, the neon is broken, so it does kind of say corn. So that was a little detail that I think we didn't mention that I wanted to mention before we.
I feel like if they could go to the House on the Rock, they could go to the actual Corn Palace. But yeah, whatever, I guess they had to show some TNA, like you said, they want to get their ratings up.
So let's talk about some significant changes from the book for those of you who are hanging out to listen to parts of the who read the book and want to compare it to the miniseries. If you haven't read the book, check out of this section. But if you have, let's talk about some significant changes from the book American Gods.
Yeah, excuse me. New media is not in the book. It was 2001. We didn't have new media. Like, we had the beginning of new media.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Facebook wouldn't show up until 2003. I guess Friendster was around. MySpace was around.
Yeah.
But we didn't really have the new media that we have today back in 01. It wasn't a thing, you know.
And it kind of makes sense that it's kind of fitting in this series because and we hear new media basically jibing on old media by saying, you know, Marilyn Monroe, Lucille Ball, David Bowie. Yeah. These are like old, old icons. It's all about, you know, Snapchat and Instagram these days. So
even then, like, she did kind of like put a Marilyn Monroe filter on her, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's iconic enough to call back to, but it's not how you represent yourself.
I think that was her way of sort of connecting old media to new media.
Right.
As we mentioned last week, Argus is not in the book, so incorporating more mythological characters from our real world experiences into this narrative. Tosin, anything else?
We have Laura. She does find ways of regenerating, but not by killing. So this is a little change here. Mm-hmm. Probably means there may be more killing to come.
Yeah, yeah, possibly. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of death in this, as we've seen already in season one, that stuff that wasn't in the book. We're going to see more death moving forward. Death and life, it's all part of the rich tapestry of American Gods. All right, moving on here to let's talk about some of the performances in this episode. Tosin, did you want to mention a performance that you found particularly compelling in this episode?
I don't know if I had one that's particularly compelling. I'd say on the opposite scale, not as compelling.
Uh-huh.
I'm still not a fan of Techno Boy. Also not really a fan of new media. I mean, I don't necessarily know that it's a performance issue. Yeah. I think it's more so
the way the characters are written.
Yeah, what the character is given. Even the episode kind of makes a little bit of a jab at it, saying, where Techno Boy says, I like old media better.
So you're not a fan of Kyun Kim as new media, huh? At least not yet.
You're gonna give her a shot. I'm definitely willing to give her a shot.
She's no Gillian Anderson. That's what.
Say again?
She's no Gillian Anderson.
Okay, so Gillian Anderson is an older actress with a storied career.
Yes.
That's true. But do think if you're going to go new media, you can't necessarily get somebody who's over 40.
Sure, sure.
It's not. To be clear, it's not her. It's
it's what she's been given to work with.
Right.
Yeah. So far,
like Ricky Whittle in season one.
Yeah.
And season two.
Oh, come on. I do think
that's
that
right. I went there.
So like episode two, where he's just kind of standing in the crucifix thing and like shaking his head. I was like, the young Ricky actors get a lot more juice than Ricky Whittle, the young shadow actor. Derek Jacobs as Sam Blackcrow. I thought she was obviously, you know, she didn't get a ton of time.
Yeah.
But she did, like I said earlier, she did express that kind of like quirky curiosity and interest in Shadow that I remember from the books, and also like a kind of a reverence for everything that was around her. Kind of like, I'm doing things my way. I don't quite remember the super tomboyness of her, but I do think that there's something indelible that DeVry Jacobs captured in her Sam Blackcrow so far, and I'm kind of interested in seeing where it grows.
Yeah, she was good. I liked her. All right, let's talk about some ephemera. This is like extra textual stuff that's not necessarily about the episode per se, but mentioned in the episode. Dwayne, did you want to talk about something here?
Yeah, just the Io myth, this idea that Hera, the sister wife of Zeus, went out of her way to turn a woman into a cow and then hide the cow so that Zeus couldn't find his lover. If you've ever watched Xena, Warrior Princess, I'm sorry, not Xena, Hercules, The Adventures of Hercules, with Kevin Sorbo, basically Hera is his foil the entire time. And she's they play on riffs of the myths or whatever, but they're constantly constantly dealing with her jealousy. And I think that's a key thing here. I would love for this series to find a way to bring a character like Hera in. You could find a whole bunch of incredible actresses to play Hera, and her Roth is legendary, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be totally cool. I'm less interested in seeing Zeus or Jove, but yeah, Hera's cool. I think it is also funny how despite the years, you know, Wednesday kills the cow, it becomes Io, and she's totally decked out like a Greek goddess in a toga. It's just kind of like, okay, or a Greek woman in a toga. So it was very, I don't know. I expected more Carlton Acre, a la Voltron, but there she was. What about you, Andy?
I just want to re-mention the thing about Hunin and Mugen that I mentioned at the top of the show when we talked about the title of the episode. So we'll have a link in the show notes that refers to that goes into detail about that the detail about those crows that make Odin known as the Raven God, basically his messengers. So.
Yeah, you know, if you they do show up in Marvel comics, Hunin and Mugen.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in the Thor comic book series. If you want like another representation of them,
yeah.
Yeah, I also feel like having read A Song of Ice and Fire, you know, ravens are not crows, but they're both corvids, and I did think it was pretty interesting how when you see like you know, Catelyn Stark or whatever, she's like dark wings, dark words. The ravens, they send messages back and forth across the Seven Kingdoms. It doesn't seem to happen outside of the Seven Kingdoms. It's just in the Seven Kingdoms. And in the same way, it's almost as if Martin, the writer of A Song of Ice and Fire and one of the producers on Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. That's kind of where he got the idea, because he does take a lot from mythology and other histories and stuff. So I thought as an ephemera, that was worth mentioning.
Yeah, and mentioning that is going to do it for our show, with the exception of going around the room here. I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can people find your work here outside on the internet when you're not talking about American Gods here on The Dominant Paradigm?
Check me out on Twitter.com/DwayneD, and then you can also check me out on Geeks of Doom. And I do other stuff with these guys. Tozen, what about you?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, and you can also find me on geeksofdoom.com. What about yourself, Andy?
You can find me at mrbabyman.com, or just do a Google search for Mr. Babyman, which is my social media handle, or Andrew Cersini, and you'll find my digital traces. You can, like Technical Boy, my digital traces on the internet there. Otherwise, we have at least a couple other podcasts that we do on occasion. We do a weekly podcast called The Drill Down, which is also hosted here at Geeks of Doom. It's a tech podcast. So if you're into the technical side of American Gods, check us out. Subscribe to The Drill Down, and you can hear us talk about tech on a weekly basis. Join us next week on The Dominant Paradigm. We'll be talking about the next episode of the American Gods titled The Greatest Story Ever Told. Wow, that is some big title shoes to fill. So we'll see if the actual episode lives up to the greatest title, The Greatest Story Ever Told. Until then, join us next week on The Dominant Paradigm, and we'll see you guys next week.